hold on, just a little while longer. Won't you hold on, just a little while longer. Won't you hold on, just a little while longer. Everything is gonna be alright.
Okay, great. Hi, I'm Patricia. Before recorded history, humans knew singing as a deep source of power. Power to change, power to heal, power to be present with what is. Right here, right now, we are remembering the ancient gift of song, using modern tech to help us tap into resilience and capacity in chaotic, difficult times. Welcome to the 145th episode of A Breath of Song. I'm so glad you chose to do this today, which is extra special because Aaron Johnson is joining us for a songwriter conversation. Hi, Aaron, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
We're here to find more ways to sing songs that help us heal, adapt, grow. Each of our voices is exactly what's needed for this. I'm coming to you straight from my home in what is now called Burlington, Vermont, on the unceded lands of the Abenaki on sand plains between the Winooski River and Lake Champlain. Aaron, you want to tell us where you're calling from?
Yeah, my normal home is Phelan, California, in Southern California. And then I'm calling from New Mexico right now because I happen to be traveling. So that's home, but I'm actually physically in New Mexico right now.
Wow.
Until tonight. I fly out tonight. So, yeah.
Well, thanks for squeezing this in, making this happen.
Oh, it's so important.
All our voices are going to turn up as they are today, where they are today. And no matter what, we can feel the connection to our breath and the vibration in our bodies. Let's find how good it can feel to sing. Last week, I shared Aaron's song, I Hear. Today, Aaron will be teaching us Hold On. We'll learn it slowly so it can settle inside you. You can begin to trust it as a resource. Let it move you into a state of flow. Then we get to enjoy a conversation with Aaron, and we'll close out with the song again at the end. You'll always be able to find this episode with full show notes and artwork in the Library of Songs at abreathofsong.com. So let's just start with a good yawn stretch, maybe rolling your shoulders. Oh, or stretching into your back. Ah, whatever feels good. And find space, allow the breath to release. Yeah, beautiful. Maybe explore some oohs and ahs, letting them slide up and down your spine. And let's let ourselves just make low sounds that just kind of, as though they're floating on top of a pond. Maybe explore with some higher, soft sounds as though you're inside the clouds. Yeah, like you're the rain falling down. And right around here we have bulbs blooming, so maybe for a second, just imagining the feel of bloom inside your body, the feel of opening, and see what that sounds like in your voice right now. And I'm going to turn it over to you to share the song.
Thank you. I really want to start with a really just important piece here of Hold On. This is a song for me that's a grief song. It's a song that sits in my body's grief. So I just want to say that as we go into this space, because in that I always feel different levels of grief. So you might feel that in some of my teaching and sharing, even right here on this live recording. This song starts out with a ooh. And this ooh can be a well, but right now it's a ooh. And it goes like this. Ooh. 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 Sometimes if you're a bass, that might feel like normal. If you're not a bass, it feels a little higher too. If you're like maybe a baritone, I'll go like a little higher. So it goes like this. If you're maybe singing out of maybe like a baritone tenor. So it goes. Important there, I think, is I typically will find a middle ground for the room. Sometimes I'll start low. This is several folks that have low voices. It's a little high. Mm-hmm. But the idea is we open with that. The song is very simple, but also has some complexity to it if you want to add in parts and beats and the chants. But there's a way that we let the spirit lead in this way. But as far as learning the song, there's a piece that kind of sets us up for the entire song, the opening. That is, the opening phrase is typically hold on. I typically start there because that's how I kind of learned it myself. But you could probably start with any phrase that would fit into this category of sing on, love on, march on. But we start with hold on. And hold on sounds like this.
Hold on just a little while longer. Won't you hold on just a little while longer. Won't you hold on. Just a little while longer, everything is gonna be all right.
Technically, you have the majority of the song intact when we have the oohs and that part, because that's basically the part that we repeat again. If I say in between each verse, I might say, sing on, love on, and that means we'll replace the hold on with that phrase or word. The thing I want to mention too in this part of the song too is that Hold On is one of those songs that can be not only improvised and adding words as they go, but I will say that it's almost a chant in some ways. So sometimes folks are out in the streets or out in the place where they aren't actually getting full melody. And understand that we can be like, hold on, it's a little while longer. It almost rides that way, but we're going to sing it through again and just kind of get a sense of how it does as a singing. But no, this song is a song that's meant for the streets. It's meant for grief. It's meant to be learned quickly. It's meant to be handed off quickly and handed off to someone else. So it's named, that's kind of the spirit of it. So here we go again. Hold on.
Hold on. Hold on. Just a little while longer. Won't you hold on?
Hold on.
Just a little while longer, won't you hold on?
Hold on.
Just a little while longer, everything is gonna be alright.
March on,
march on. Just a little while longer, won't you march on?
March on.
Just a little while longer. Won't you march on?
March on.
Just a little while longer. Everything is gonna be alright.
Love on.
Love on. Just a little while longer. Won't you love on?
Love on.
Just a little while longer. Won't you love on? Just a little while longer, everything is gonna be alright.
Now, I will say that if you're in a song circle with me, I will probably add this piece, and that is called Jamming Out. So we kind of take, usually in a song circle, we'll do a vocal percussion certification where we kind of give out some instructions on how to do some beats. And so just for the sake of that, we go back to the ooh, but inevitably I invite us to jamming out. And that's for the sake of this moment here to give you all the invitation to add some rhythms. We usually go, I'll say something to the effect of the audience, I'll say, jamming out. And it'd be like, boom, boom, boom.
So, Aaron, this gospel song was written by Reverend Cleophas Robinson, Jr., right? It's really unusual for me to have a song on the show that's not composed by the song leader. Can you tell me why this song is important for you to carry? And kind of, you said you feel grief when you sing it. You move into a grief space when you sing it. And you mentioned it being used on the streets and in action. Can you talk to me a little bit more about that, about carrying this song that came to you from elsewhere, but has come to mean so much to you?
Oh, yeah. I think for me, songs are stories. It keeps people alive, and the song kept me alive, kept me present. I think in some ways, rebirthed my ability to be present during the death and post-death of my father. And so for me, it feels like... I grew up and still my family is very musical. We sing a lot. It's a part of our culture in church and in family work. And so one of the things I realize when I look at that song, when I think about that song, this is 2010. My father died in a horrific accident.
I'm so sorry.
And I remember there's a couple of key, no, I appreciate that. There's a couple of key pieces of notice about death. I'm not new to death. Death has been a part of my family as a small, black, poor congregation. We went to 4 to 5 funerals a year. Death was a constant cadence in our community. But that being said, it didn't necessarily prepare me for my own father's surprise death. And I'll say that because his death was devastating enough, without getting into graphic details, I'll just say that I was... the one who discovered his remains. I was the one that was with him last before family. And I remember walking into the house and had the burden and also the experience of telling everybody else that our father had passed away. And I can't tell you enough that when you open your mouth to tell someone something that horrific news, how it just changes the rest of your life in that moment. But you know, you have that kind of moment where everything is fine until you open your mouth and everything's not fine.
Yeah.
And that devastation lasted all that night. Until the following day, he died on a Saturday. On that Sunday, we canceled formal service, but we went to the chapel as we announced to the community that my father had passed in a horrific accident. And people came from all over the place at different times. Kind of waves came and stayed and left and came and stayed and left. And we stayed the entire time in complete shock and devastation. And one of the things that just organically started happening top of the day on Sundays, we started singing songs, just congregational songs, hymns, his favorite songs, special songs. And I was just in complete shock. I wasn't even crying at the time. 2010, I had not access to my tears. I was in a lockdown on the verge of a mental collapse or maybe coming in and out of a mental collapse. I'm not sure how to describe my actual state of mind. But I remember starting to sing this song. I feel like it was later than the day after lunch. We started singing Hold On. I can't remember if I started. I don't think I did. I think someone else started singing it. But it started being sung. And it was the first inkling, first kind of hint that this grief might be bearable. I might could see another end of it. And when I hear that song, hold on, just a little while longer, those words take me right back to that place of really not having a therapist or a mental health plan. We were in a spot of our family. We were just work, 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 move, 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 crisis after crisis. We were constantly moving through crisis after crisis. This is not holistic resistance, anti-racist, kind of a container. It was mentorship. It was Black poverty. It was Black magic. It was you're just moving from day to day. So this is not a place where I could take time off and heal. This is not that design. We just collapsed and everything else just started to collapse around us. Financially, everything else. So the idea is that that song was the lighthouse on the hillside amongst a tremendous storm of not just poverty and death, but just devastation. And as we kind of climbed out of that depression, financial dissolve, job collapsing, everything that had come out of that death, hold on just a little while. I sing that song probably every day for the first couple of months. And then after a while, it was just in my body of hold on just a little while longer. Everything is gonna be all right. Those are everything's gonna be all right when it didn't look like it was gonna be all right, right? So I kept singing that. It was like, this wasn't like me manifesting something that was impossible. People said, oh, you're manifesting. I was just trying to keep breathing. But in some ways, this is what we always do as Black folks. You think back, because we manifested, right? Woke up this morning with my mind. We ain't free when we're singing that song per se. We're seeking it. We're manifesting. Yeah. We're speaking to it, right? So this is me in my personal life. This is hold on. Every day for weeks on end. We're about to lose our house. My dad's name was on the loan. We got that figured out. Hold on a little while longer. About to lose the church because we couldn't pay for that. Hold on a little while. That got figured out. We got 5 acres next to the church. Supposed to lose that too. Hold on. Got that figured out. Step by step by step, I just sang that song as a mantra. I was not doing song circles formally in the sense that I do them now. I was just in my family group, in my own, mumbling to my own self, in night while I'm crying. So when I'm now on this side of holistic resistance and this side, I've been singing for now 8 years, and I've been singing for my whole life, but as far as in the container of holistic resistance and song circles and being introduced to the song community, that song takes me right back to that moment where I felt like all was lost. And so it just keeps it, no matter how I change out all of my songs and my song list, and we add all kind of little parts, we improve and shift and think, this song will solely be there. Yeah. It will solely be there indefinitely. Yeah. It's not my song, but it's my song.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
It serves the purpose of 100 therapists and 10,000 self-care days that weren't accessible to me during that time. So I sing Hold On. That's what I channel. That's what I feel. It reminds me of my beginnings. And in some ways, I feel like I was rebirthing myself.
Wow. I just need to take that story in for a second. So, so powerful. And what I love about that story here in A Breath of Song is that the reason I made this podcast was to access, to make a library of these songs that do that for us, that give us a way through, that meet the need that we have. And when I started it, it was as a very personal thing. It's interesting. It's become a little bit of a resource for song leaders who are turning to it and finding songs for community in it, which is beautiful. And I love that. And I fully support that work. But it really started as a, what are the songs that I need to sing to myself? So thank you. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing how deeply song has moved. So you identify sort of as 8 years ago when you started singing in a more formal way in community singing. Talk to me about that. What happened 8 years ago?
Well, I would say, you know, we did song circles that look just like the song circles that I see now on some level with my family group, Vivacious, through our church community, and just folks that would be in village with us at the time.
Yeah.
I had no clue there was an organized, connected song community doing their thing. Had no clue that y'all existed. And so I was doing a song circle in San Francisco. And this wasn't 8 years ago. This is like 2017, 18, right before the pandemic hit. And I did a song circle and this guy was like, you got to meet Katie Tyron. So Katie, he goes, you got to meet my friend Katie. She's the songs too, like song, like, really great. And sure enough, I think on a Friday or a Saturday that we had a part of a series of workshops I was doing in the San Francisco area, Katie came and we spoke after and she was like, oh my God, you never heard of the song community? I was like, no. She was, this is what we do. And I was, you know, I had my own methodology teaching that day and she had been through my song circle and she low-key sent an email to Lisa Littlebird and said, Aaron, there's a summit happening. I know it's full, sold out, but I think we should have Aaron come to the summit. And that's when I got introduced formally to the broad network of song circle people. Holistic Resistance, prior to that, we call it an 8-year marker, was bringing music almost by accident, quietly into our facilitation. So we have a workshop, we'll have a song in the workshop, we might open with some sounding. Throughout the workshop, we would use it softly, but it wasn't like, I've been singing for 20 years in my family group, Vivacious, but, or more than that, 25 years plus, but that was like, still, I wasn't sure how to bring Holistic Resistance and song together. It was a part of myself, who I was, but as a consultant in workshop, I was still trying to like, am I going to really customize this? And so what happened was, as I kept bringing it more and more into my atmosphere, when I realized what the song circle community had been doing, I was like, oh, snap. And so I got, you know, Lisa Littlebird and Lindsay Scott and Shireen, and there's a lot of folks that started getting introduced to that were doing this on a much more regular basis. And I was kind of mind blown and excited. So I think the 8 years is when I was kind of bringing it in. But then that was like, okay, this is something we make a big deal. And I remember that kind of, it was that, plus a couple other song circles we kind of quickly organized in Seattle that had a tremendous impact just on our overall access to people's hearts. And I realized that we need to not do a workshop series in air without having a song circle either before or after. We come into a community. If we come to a community and we're new, we come in and like on Friday, we have a song circle on a Friday, a workshop on a Saturday, and then like a deep dive, which is a little heavier, on a Sunday. And we have people come to the song circle, get introduced to the energy, figure out how to show up in a space, and then the following day they might say, okay, I might come into a workshop if that makes sense. I really like what happened on the song circle. And they like, wow, workshop went really well. They might go further into a deep dive on a Sunday. So that's kind of our model on tour. When we travel, we kind of combine song circle, workshop, deep dive as a way to help people for the first time get exposed to doing anti-racist work and being in community with each other.
So you're combining anti-racist work with the song circles. Is this under umbrella of Holistic Resistance?
Correct. Yeah. So if say I'm on tour and I'll be in like Denver, Sebastopol, California, whatever community I'm in, I often have the organizer, I'll say, can we organize a song circle first? Uh-huh. Then organize a workshop second and a deep dive third if they want to do a series of that. So that would be how we would tour. So when I go into a given city, myself or collective, we have that model in place. Because when people are new, they might have heard the work on the line, but they aren't sure if they really trust the container in which it's being held on a sensitive topic of anti-racism. So we got to start with a song circle's way to like meet low stakes. It's donation optional. There's not a big feast. Everyone's there. We're all in song. I've done song circles before. And they kind of fill me out. Because sometimes people get concerned when it comes to a workshop of like, you know, his brother's gonna come here and abuse us verbally and just like, what energy is he bringing? Is he able to like, what's his vibe? Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, it's the on-ramp structure. And so we found that song circles are a profound place to teach anti-racist ideas and thoughts, but it's also a great way to get introduced and drop in and liberate our voices. And so that's what our song circles kind of have served over a structure of a tour. We oftentimes structure it that way.
Nice. Why do you think it is that song does that? Why do you think it is that song opens up people?
Well, I think song can open up people. I think there's places where song can actually shut people down. But I think the way that we try to notice, the Holistic Resistance tries to bring music and open people up, is that most of our song circles is inviting people to reclaim their voices. And so, you know, I'm one of those folks in the song community that really doesn't, I don't say phrases like, we're off pitch. I don't even say that in any of my songs. I don't say we're off rhythm. I don't use those phrases. I might bring us in other different ways or remodel it a bit, but I'm very careful not to attack folks. And I know I'm not attacking them, but to really critique them harshly. And I know I've gotten some pushback in the song community, but this is really important because I find that one of the most important things we want to do in our song circles for Holistic Resistance is open people up and allow it. But I find that if I get a room of, say, 30 people, I would say half have been hurt, if not more, of I can't sing, I shouldn't sing, I'm not that good at singing. That's just like a it goes in this, like, trauma of America, I'll say at this point, when I go to sing in elementary schools. And so I say that because with that hurt in place, people kind of come a little tight and like, I'm just going to let the singer sing. I'm going to mumble. I'm going to be quiet. And I'm saying, yes, mumbling is sacred in my song circles. Mm-hmm. I want you to mumble. I want you to whisper. I want you to sing like you're an angel. If that's what your skills are, you're all welcome. But I try and make it that way. And I've gone on song circles. I left more stressed than I was when I got there because the song leader was so just pounding the audience and pushing us. And then you're off. You need to quiet down. You're kind of, and just constantly just kind of run us through the ringer. And so I just want to name that in that container, I don't feel like music actually serves its purpose in its true way. Mm-hmm. I feel like for me, there is a way that we want it to sound as best as it can, but I always like to broaden my experience of what the best we can sound can sound like. Because to me, I will always sacrifice tight harmonies if I'm able to invite someone in the room that hasn't sang in 10 years to start singing, to start mumbling, to start crying and singing and mumbling. I will always sacrifice a tight harmony to that experience. Oftentimes we get to both anyway. But the idea is that music doesn't necessarily on its own open us up. I think it's us as song leaders to really track what it means to bring people into community with voices that aren't just seasoned song circle participants. And so for me as an anti-racist practitioner and an anti-oppression tracker, I'm really careful to really think, what can I do? And I'm getting better every day at this, but what can I do over the last 8 years specifically I've been focused on this to really say, what does it mean to let music happen? So I think what happens is that when can music actually do that? Like, how does music actually do that? I think music actually does that when it comes from a sincere human experience, when it's not trying to be capitalized or shaped into a way to be monetized. Mm-hmm. But when music can show up, if you think of a little baby, I was hanging out with some babies just yesterday, and they're just like, that's all of us have probably tried this or have done this for many years or ourselves. My point is there's something pure about their freedom, because they have been told they're not good enough yet. They aren't told all the parts of music. And some babies can get it in ways that we don't even get it, because they have it in their body. They're more raw. So my point is that there's a human, honest place. And if we're tapping in some version of that well that we all have access to, that we kind of started from, that's where I feel, Aaron Johnson feels, like that's where music becomes medicine. I wouldn't say that all music, and I would say the majority of music, is meant to entertain us, and it stops there. But I think the core of music is meant to do so much more spiritual nutrients than that. And I think in the song community, we tap into that. And so I feel like on its own, it does not, unfortunately, in American culture, become medicine. But I think by really tracking some of the historic, I love how you open your podcast talking about, since before documented history and before humans made song, this is clearly a part of who we are. I think coming from that space, it becomes medicine and does that. But I don't think on its own, I wouldn't say that if I go to 10 song circles, I would say about 3 of them really, really track that skillfully. Hmm. Some songs I go to, I love the song leaders. I love them. They're peers of mine. I will sing with them for life. And I go to their circles and I'm like, people are not singing because they're thinking they aren't good enough. People were starting to sing. They're excited. But because of the level of singing just got enhanced and the requirement of musicality got enhanced, people just opted out. And they're okay to sacrifice those folks. And I'm just like, I don't want to sacrifice those folks. Yeah. I want them to ones to sing. The singers are going to be singing. And I want them to be singing. But the ones that are like, I'm not good, that's the one. I've been told when I was 8 years old I shouldn't sing. And I'm now 55. Yeah. That's the one. Let's claim it now. Let's grieve it now and claim it out. That's the voice.
You know, from somebody who was raised in sort of a classical music tradition, did a lot of piano, was told early on that I didn't have a voice, couldn't sing, and so stopped singing because I can't sing, I'm not good enough to sing. So I would play piano, and finding my voice, finding that I could sing, that it was okay for me to sing, was a real education. It was a real experience. And one of the things that I learned through that process, because I had to learn how to sing as an adult, was how people worry about pitch, people worry about rhythm. But people's pitch and rhythm goes wonky when they're tight. when they're tense, that creates muscle conditions where you can't sing on pitch and you can't sing rhythmically because your muscles are too tight to do the work that they're there to do, right?
Yeah.
So for me, learning how to make sound without thinking about singing and how to listen to the sound that I make and be okay with that was a huge, huge turn and healing. And I bring that to my song circles too, because I've learned that people don't sing any better. They don't sing better when you say, oh, you're not singing on pitch. That doesn't make help them sing on pitch.
No.
That doesn't fix a thing, no. Right? But if you help them feel into their bodies, if you help them release a little bit, if you help them relax a little bit, if you help them tune into how it feels physically to sing, then they start crying, then they start laughing, then it, you know, then they start feeling, and then their voice opens up. But there's something about the sound of a room singing, a unison sound, doesn't have to be complicated, just a unison sound that is so beautiful to me.
Yeah.
Even as a song leader, I find I can lose myself in just that experience, that physical experience of many voices together.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a wonderful Bliss is Ordinary podcast with you that we will link in the show notes. I really highly recommend that everyone listen to Yam and Jesse's podcast, all of them, all of the episodes, but especially yours, when you talk about approaching community song leading with a very different attitude towards pitch from the right and wrong that many people experienced in music class chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make sure we will link to that. So I'm wondering now whether when you're using song in service of anti-racism work, can you do that with any song at all? Or are you pulling particular songs in?
That's a good point. I mean, you can teach the anti-racist song very oppressively. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I think there's a way that I just want to be clear, like, because the song say freedom, if I'm really shaming and cornering you, and there's a way that, like, I can feel the oppression in the kind of handoff of the song. And I want to track something that oftentimes I think is missed, especially as we're still integrating the song community, is that one of the hurts that Black folks, I was in New Orleans doing a song circle, and this came up very strong, is that one of the parts of oppression that lands on Black bodies is that we have to be excellent. I mean, 2 times, 3 times better than any white person that we're going to sing next to, get a job interview next to. In order just to be normal, we had to outperform. So that was just like a normal 90s. It was like unspoken word. Like, if I lost a solo in choir because I was just as good as the other white fellow, I was like, I shouldn't have got it because I wasn't 3 times as good as that person and that whatever.
Uh-huh.
And so the double or 3 times is better is a common trauma story. And why I say that now is because you're going to find that almost every song leader that's African heritage in the song community right now is excellent and demands excellence. And I totally understand.
Mm.
You can't come here limping as a singer, as a Black body person. I'm a singer. And if you're African heritage and you're a singer, you are a singer. Okay, so I just want to name that because of that trauma story, either acutely aware of their body or almost like, oh yeah, that is a part of who I am. And they're excellent. And I am not here to say you shouldn't be excellent. Excellence, great, it's fine. But I just want to name it. That's a trauma story, I'll call it, that I have to really track. And I want to name here, and I say this often, I say it because it really helps shape who I am. I have dyslexia, right? So sending emails and writing is hard for me to do. Can I do it? Of course, but talk of text is huge. I love all those things. But a name that dyslexia has really helped me understand that it really slowed me down because I'm an excellent speaker. I'm a good athlete. I have, you know, a robust immune system most of the time. I rarely get sick. I get maybe a flu every 5 years, something ridiculous like that. And so there's a way that my disability can be hidden behind my articulate voice or my presentation or my confidence now. But I just want to name that there's something important to go out because there's a lot of jobs I couldn't get. I was struggling financially for a long time because of my dyslexia, couldn't pass the test, whatever. I say that because excellence was kind of permanently taken from me in kind of academic and college and corporate world. I say that right. because it slows me down. Even when I teach songs or all my songs are very simple. They're very, because of my dyslexia, it's easy longer to learn things. And I see song people, song comedians, I love them. You sing a song, and the beat's here, and they got it in two takes. Not Aaron. I have a disability. So it takes me five times as long to learn a song from someone or to even teach a new song to someone or to jump in with someone, even though I'm well established in the community. I named that disability because it humbles my heart, but it also changes and shapes my teaching. So going back to an oppressive song or songs of liberation, I feel that the pedagogy of song leaders, the problem about the song leader right now is no one has really disabilities in the song community I can see easily. Most people in the song community are A-plus students, can spell, write, they're financially stable, most part that I see and observe. So don't have any overt challenge of like, I have a hard time even being in this space because I'm in chronic pain all the time or it might be. So I'm just tracking that we're still diversifying our group to not just being the folks that are in like thin, able-bodied, somewhat financially stable and all the things that they kind of come with the privilege of being a song leader, which is not always the case. But I'll say that skews that way for the majority. Now, I haven't interrogated everybody in the group. There might be some dyslexia as well in there that I'm missing. But I say that because we're getting there. We're getting some folks that are in different kind of access needs to their body coming up. But for the most part, when I go to most song circles, I don't see people tracking disability or tracking that way in how they're trying to deliver their music. It's like get the music right. The music almost becomes the primary focus. So when it comes to teaching a song, I think there's songs taught from a lens of disability, a lens from oppressed populations that are observing themselves. Not just I'm African heritage and therefore I'm anti-racist. I'm African heritage and I'm really assessing how oppression can show up in myself, show up in community and have an analysis that I can influence how I teach this song. So I think if that's a part of it, it could almost be a jam session. It's something that I see Bob McFerrin has done early on that really kind of tilted the music career sideways back in the 80s and before of what he was able to popularize or mainstream the idea of improvising. There's a freedom to that. Even though Bob McFerrin has never raised his hand as anti-racist, there is a liberative energy and freedom. Now, he gets really technical in his philosophy. That being said, I will say that there's something around the improvising he opened up in the world that allowed us to think more freedom, more improvise as magic and actual established music that allows, I think, for us to show up and be liberatory. So I think songs that I sing are definitely anti-racist songs. But I hope that the most anti-racist thing I do is not the singing of the song only, but it's how I teach it, how I back it up and use it in ceremony or use it in a life that becomes a liberatory act. And so for me, I think that when I reach for folks to access their voices, I think that's a liberative act. Anytime you give someone access to their voice, regardless of what they're singing, as far as it's positive and not like oppressive music, that's a liberatory act because it allows us to really drop into our bodies in a way that I think is really important. It's kind of anti-capitalist in so many ways to be in your body in that way. And then, yes, I think the singing songs that have been handed down from my ancestors to now is definitely a responsibility I take very seriously as a song leader to sing as many songs of resistance formally. But I also think that when I teach those songs that I'm constantly tracking myself in that trauma story of being excellent and being perfect. I want to respect the history. I want to tell the stories. I want to sing it as authentic to our culture. At the same time, I want to make sure that as I deliver it, that my delivery has some consciousness about making sure people feel like they're getting access to this, even at a beginning level. Because I know that when folks are fighting oppression historically, they weren't trying to get the notes right. They were trying to find grounding in their bodies. And the notes oftentimes were amazingly nice and amazing. That wasn't their, like, mm-hmm. from my experience of it, wasn't their primary goal. Mm-hmm. That was more into the performing era when trying to monetize music. But where its birthplace from and its actual survival narrative, it was maybe to sing a song, to send a message so we can get to freedom, but you know, it was a code song, but it was not necessarily this sounds good. It's like this is a conversation of me and the universe in a very system where I think it feels impossible for me to have freedom. So I think to me the freedom is a song, but it's also has to be embodied by the song leader.
Yeah. I love the way that you take anti-racism work, which can sometimes get put into a little box, like this is this limited story, and you're saying, no, this is a story of oppression. And oppression is something that everybody can find, has experienced in some way, somewhere in their own lives, right? So there's this,
yeah.
this you're describing it as liberatory, this freedom, this practice of freedom. It's not, it's an absolutely, I'm stumbling over myself here. I feel like I'm trying to say I hear inclusion there. You know, you have this, the story of dyslexia, but, and everybody has a story, even the people who look so technically gifted have stories of things they could not do, things they hit where they weren't able to do whatever it was that they had set out for themselves as this is what I should be able to do. And they've, I've seen Bobby McFerrin struggling with Parkinson's and his voice not singing in tune all the time. Holy you know, this is somebody whose skill with his voice is legendary, right? And he's had to find other ways through. All of us are going to hit at some point a place where skill is not going to take us. And it's the ability to be present with whoever we are then, when we're not shiny, that gives us access to this deeper power.
100%. There's something interesting about shiny. I like that phrase because I oftentimes use that too when it comes to polished music. And I think in the 90s, we prayed to get into a studio and to clean our voices up and to get it all hooked up into the studio. It was like a dream. We could scrape enough money together to get into the studio. That was like 95, 97, 98, 2000s. That was like our goal. And I fall as technology, cell phones got more powerful, cameras on our phones became really quality. I've seen this place where all of a sudden that idea of premium studio or premium budget got leveled out a bit to where a lot of people could create a lot of really high quality video and audio with just in their pocket, which is amazing. But what I also see this era now where, you know, we have the AI technology getting warmed up and taking on music and making sounds and whatnot. And I'm realizing that the shinies is gonna just be falling into the category of like, is that even real or is that a human? I think that the imperfection is gonna be signals for us to go, that was a real human experience. And that's gonna become a sacred ground here very soon. And so I just wanna name that I feel like a little bit of investment in allowing a little bit of the breath, a little bit of the human error to be present to signal to us, I'm not a robot. I'm a human reaching for you.
Yeah.
I'm not a paid conglomerate. I'm a human reaching for you. And I think that part is going to be something that's going to be really important. And that being said, I think it kind of helps us understand that was always important. I think skills and being good at something has its limits. But I feel like if it's not nested in a human experience and liberation experience, I feel like it's going to find itself hollow, monetized, and not having its intended purpose ultimately.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of the power that is in the music that Bobby McFerrin has made, and he would say this, I think, himself, I've heard him say, that he goes out there and he just is present. That's what he's doing. And that's a huge practice, right? it's so hard to do. And it's also so easy. It's so complete.
Yeah.
When you step into a room with a new group of people, what are you noticing? What are you paying attention to?
I think my labor as a song leader has been, and unfortunately still is, to remind the population that I'm human. That's almost my first goal. Is to kind of help shake off the black brute narratives, the projections of who I am. And now at this stage, there is a group of people that actually know who I am. They've been in songs before, so it's not like the collective, but there's always a group of folks that get moved deeply, the fact that I speak so tenderly of my own experience, that I share from a place that will almost give me space to have some tears if that is available or needed in my experience. That for me to have some basic human emotions and sensitivities feels impressive because black men, cis black men should not be thinking this way. So there's a way that I have to kind of spend some time kind of reminding the collective, hey, I'm human. I'm like a full profile human being. So that's the first kind of low key task that song has done very effectively, almost more effective than anything else that I do. After that is somewhat being achieved, the other piece that feels important for me is to start to lay out some on-ramps, which is part of the sensitivity piece, the on-ramps for every voice in the room. And so I have a little share on that. So for me, when I walk into them, that's the things I'm tracking. And I think what I've noticed is I have seen folks promise themselves that they were just coming to a song circle to listen. They were not planning on singing because they were convinced they were not a singer. And then they usually find me sometime after the song circle and they say something to me like, Aaron, I came here as not a singer. I haven't sang in X amount of years. And I sang today. Now, I don't want to scare them by bursting into tears and grabbing them and tell them how much I appreciate them. But oftentimes, we'll do something a little more refined, like put my hand on my heart and look them in the eye and tell them how much I appreciate them sharing that. But inside, I am screaming in joy and grief and appreciation of that experience. And so for me, that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the person that's sitting back saying, I took all I could do to get here. Maybe I'm someone on a spectrum. Maybe I have a shape in my body is shaped a certain kind of way that doesn't get accepted normally. Maybe I'm fill in the blank. Whatever the story is, I look for those folks first to see if we can like notice each other. And I don't want to put them on blast. I'm not staring at these folks. Everybody's how uncomfortable that can be. But I'm tracking them. Tracking them. So that's what I bring into the space when I try and track the space. And then I do track my singers, right? So these folks that maybe I know are singers, or I can look at their face and tell their eyes, and they're like, give me like multiple notes and harmonies, give me some challenge here, and like push me, and I'm here to learn. This is like a high level. I'm ready to work, and I get them like, getting ready. Those I see those folks too, and I try and track them as well because their energy is going to have a huge impact on the folks that are like, I'm just trying. These folks are like, they sit up straight. Maybe they're aesthetically attractive. They're add weight, they've had good breakfast, lunch, and dinner, they have their green drink, their good energy, these are my favorite people, I love these folks. At the same time, they oftentimes aren't even tracking their peripheral, they aren't even tracking how their energy should be there, yeah. And that they just hone in a little bit, they can be a little more patient, they can just be a little quieter actually, and just like their overall energy, not just the volume, but just like the overall energy of, I got to figure it out, next thing, all that kind of energy, and they don't say it, I can see them bite at the bait of like, more complexity, more challenge, I mean, I want to prove how good I am. Yeah. From the last thing, because I'm a good student, the good student energy. Yeah. And much as I love them, I'm tracking their energy because they're impacting the folks that never could be a good student because getting to school was just getting to class or getting to that oppressive system called school was everything they could do. Yeah. That I'm trying to track. And sometimes these are projections, but I have been eerily accurate on that room. And so oftentimes I have some combination of that, right? And this can vary from, you know, the queer collective groups that are there to the African heritage folks that might sneak into my song circles to the folks that are, you know, coming from all different race, poor, whatever it might be, they're coming to that room. I'm tracking those energies. And oftentimes I'll say something to the fact of like, we didn't rehearse and wow, look how we all meet each other. Just kind of always giving language to try and let us notice what we're actually up to, what magic is actually happening. The fact that we're able to show up in this kind of, I wouldn't say neutral ground, but ground that we wouldn't otherwise even cross paths or share something as intimate as a song. Or a collective singing together, often on my song circles, a cappella music, because I don't use any instruments to really allow the voice to show up. And so for me, that is what I kind of track in a room if I'm able to. Sometimes a room is too big and it's too many people to really get a full sense of that, depending on how it's set up. But generally speaking, I'm able to assess the people coming and going into my circles in that way. And I say it, but I try and express it or model it more so than say it, is that I try and track how many of us can drop into the sacredness of this experience. Like, how can we really make this the grief ceremony it needs to be? How can we make this the practice for the performance that will be at the bedside of a loved one? Practice for the time when we will be having a birth experience and someone's coming into this world and we want them to know that we're waiting on them with excitement. How do we practice at that level? And I think that's also intimacy I'm always trying to bring into the space, the maturity of the emotional intelligence I want to bring into the space. I want that to be kind of our goal, not to just make our harmonies only tighter, but I hope we understand that these songs can hold up at the depth of coming into this world or coming out of this world or deciding if we want to stay in this world. These songs have the purpose to remind us that there's a reason to hold on a little while longer. And I think that's why I try and bring every time I have the gift of a song circle, if it's two people, which I've had, or if it's 6 or 7 people, I try and bring that level of reach for each other.
Mm. When you participate in a circle that somebody else is leading, what have you noticed that you've really appreciated that somebody else has done?
Yeah, I'm so blown away by every song leader. I've been able to participate in their song circles in the context of, first of all, I appreciate people that are writing songs consistently for song circles. They're easy to teach, or they're have a message that's really sober in a way that I think is not so sober that people can't reach for it, it's too far, but it's like that middle ground. I think one of the things I have really appreciated is how directing choir, I directed the State FA Honor Choir for 10 years back in the day. And I was so nervous because I was not a choir director. Someone said, I want you to direct this choir. And I was like, I don't even know like the hands and how to conduct. I saw my choir director always wove his hand at us, but I never knew what he was actually doing. Like,
right.
It's the whole philosophy of like timing and this. And I kind of got a sense of what he was, but I kind of visually mumbled what he was trying to do. I wasn't taking notes of now. I know how to conduct. Every conductor has this kind of signature movement, but I actually don't know what they're doing. But in the song community, I have saw some amazing conductors when they kind of point at themselves when they're singing and it reached for you. They have all this way of body directing that I have found some of the best choir directing ever that made sense. Like, it actually made sense. Like, I understood through their hand gestures of like, it's me, now it's you, now it's I got this lovely sense of body directing. I mean, everyone, it seems to have their own little thing, but it all feels like it's practical. You can come in and go, oh, when they're going like this, that's me. When they're pointing their fingers, that's you. But that's just that. They have this other ways where it's like me on that part. And they can, the way they can stop other groups and start another, I just love how they're able to direct. I think the conducting in a song community is some of the best choir conducting I've ever seen. And partly because, not because it's just technically amazing, but I think they're really able to quickly figure out a body language that most people catch on to. Often I've teach some pretty layered experiences musically. So that's been something I really have enjoyed as a whole. And then I think too, there's something about song leading that's kind of a hybrid between performance and a stand-up comedian and a choir director that kind of makes a song leader, I think, really effective on some level. Maybe a little bit of sprinkling like grief ceremony on top of that, or grief experience on top of that. Maybe a little bit of other things like parenting that could be useful in that narrative. But there's something about the way people can embody setting a container with either herbs or a room or a fire, and just something about being able to track that a part of song circles can be like, hey, we gather around, we don't really think about it, and we sing. But I'm seeing us really slow down and go, what is the experience? What art do you want to have on the wall? What kind of herbs want to have? What kind of altars want to make? What kind of ways that we want to really show up for this experience, either thematically, energetically, that feels like a very powerful skill set to bring as I facilitate a lot. I think watching other song leaders lead has been a powerful place to enhance my ability to facilitate. And facilitation is on the surface a simple act, but really when you get deeper into facilitating, it's a profound practice of how to bring complex topics to a group. And so I think for me, I think the song community has been some of the best facilitators. In my experience, I mean, world-class facilitators that are at a beach with 20 people having a profound experience. Because I think they're not just saying, here's a song. They're really designing in a container that is now becoming almost standard in most song circles, where it's not near as casual as I think it was historically. And I wasn't here in the early years, but I think it's just me going to like drum circles at the beaches and other people that were not in the organized song community. It was very much accidental. And there's very little like, everything's very thought. People are thinking of people. And that feels profound when I think of like what I'm seeing in the song community. Hence why I'm encouraged to keep investing in diversity and all the things that are there. I see a sincere collective of people. Like, I am invested in shaping this community for more accessible to more people. So
I want to pull on one of the things you said about slowing down, because the song I shared of yours last week, I Hear Your Voice From My Heart to Your Soul, feels to me like that's exactly what it does. It kind of slows everything down to where I can really pay attention. And I love that. I love that experience of being slowed down. And because of the slowness, it's there's a deeper attention. So it's just interesting to me that you're noting that you're seeing in some of the song spaces that you are enjoying as well, you're seeing that same slowness and valuing that.
Yes. I think that's the sign of someone that's newer to song circles. They're not slowing down. They're kind of rushing to teach as many songs as possible in 90 minutes, yeah. whatever their time is. And that's not wrong with getting a lot of songs in per se, but the speed does matter, I think, especially in this kind of culture of healing that we're in. I think where our voices as a culture.
Yeah. So I was lucky to experience your facilitation first in a group that you led for white community song leaders shortly after the murder of George Floyd, when many in the U.S. and elsewhere hoped that there would be a huge shift in white understanding of racism. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, has the conversation changed since 2020 at all?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's layered. I think there's a way that it's progressed in a way that feels obvious. And that is that I think the collective misstep, I'll call it, that most white people did during that time is they overcompensated their capacity. They were just like, they stepped so far into what they were willing to do is too radical for their ecosystem and too radical for the country as a whole. And so there's a bit of like exhaustion. You know, I think that whole period of time in George Floyd and its intensity was about 3 months before people got either tired or started going back to work or got scared by COVID again, as we had like multiple waves keep hitting us, the news kept covering it, that it got hard to stay and have attention. So that was a collective kind of response. And so in that context, we're not only have we made some change, but the change has mostly been interrogated and attacked by the backlash. And so it's not like we can feel the full benefit of what we hoped for during that time. But what I also noticed is that there was a handful of white folks, and these are actually a lot of folks that I maybe thought would kind of fade with the rest. And I smiled, I could cry as much like a smile right now, that heard the many other black voices said, pace yourself. Pace yourself. Even if it means you're not even marching at all during 2020, which was like the ultimate sin for a white person not to go out and march. Even if you don't even march right now, to really settle in and go, I'm going to set, and maybe I'm 35 and I'm pretty strong, I'm looking to live another 30 years. What pace gives me the stamina to be the most consistently effective in my positionality with my wealth or lack thereof to show up even after the news stops covering it, even after the streets get quiet? There's still a ton of work, if not more work, to be done. And I say that because I think there's a small critical mass, some in the song community, some in the anti-racist community, and there's a lot of folks that were looking at me dead in the eye during that time. Aaron, I am in for life. I will take a bullet for a black person. I'm going to march every day. And within 2 months, they were exhausted and couldn't look at the internet anymore, talking to their therapist like they should be, thinking they're all recovered, getting there. And they're still in a hiatus waiting for maybe this election this November to get re-energized at the streets for another 2 months. But what's important to understand is that I think the progress has been doing what it always has been doing, is that it's always a critical mass of a small group of folks that we never know their name, we don't even see them on Instagram posting that they did it, are saving people's lives, dismantling oppression, giving their all, and we'll never know who they are per se. Maybe a handful of us that got their hand at our back that keeps us above water. But I just want to name that 7 people came on our property right after January 6th march on the Capitol. 7 people came on our property armed with weapons, called the police, threatening us, saying that we didn't work on our property. This is all, I live in a little Trump utopia where I live. This is not like new. I've lived there for 25 years. And same sense, I never had this kind of level of threat on my land.
Yeah.
And we sent out an email to fundraise. This is during like 2021. It's like during that kind of height of the moment. And we were able to raise enough money. I think it was like $70,000 to put a fence up around our 11 acres to have protection. And what's been beautiful is that we've had basically zero encroachment from any of our neighbors since that fence was up, right? That's what name us. Hallelujah, right?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm in tears. The community came through.
Yeah.
The community came through. It's like huge. I can do my work here. Grief to Action, stay alive.
Yeah.
And we just sent out an email 2 weeks ago for our Grief to Action fund for 2 black mothers that are fighting for life right now as we speak, right? And their babies. And we got barely maybe $1,000, right? And that's expected. It's expected. Because we're not in a flashpoint. If this was 2020, we sent that same email, I can guarantee we would have those mothers taken care of, and then maybe 5 more mothers taken care of.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying that I've gone through the season a couple of times over the last 10 years where I remember one of our core members' mother passed away, and we did a fundraiser, not doing a flashpoint. This is before George Floyd. And we got barely $300,000 to put her on the ground. We had to come with some other loans and credit cards to get her on the ground. And I say, you know, within 2 months of that, or maybe a year of that death, we had George Floyd happen. We raised almost $100,000, maybe $6,000, maybe $20,000 short of $100,000 to build this fence, which is very expensive. I don't know how expensive it was to build a fence around 11 acres. But the idea is that you can see this idea that people could give right now. And I'm not trying to guilt people, but it's naming that I am not surprised that it was crickets right now. I can guarantee you, come November 20th, let's say something uncomfortable happens, and we try to help the same black mothers that still need help then, I can guarantee you we're raised 10 times as much during that flashpoint. Right now, we're kind of like, maybe Biden will live to 105. We'll be okay. Maybe we'll be okay. The idea is that I see this cadence in this. The people that gave $1,000, thank you so much. Because I'm going to tell you something. Those folks, the same folks that said they're a critical mass, they don't have much. But I'm going to back you when no one else is like, oh, you know, it's like, you know, people, I know it's like there's two wars happening. And right now, it's more about, you know, that. My thing is, hold that war. Hold the oppression still, the machine's still going, right? So my point is that those of us in the trenches, even though it gets really loud, I have learned to really pace my energy to understand that it's the critical mass. And it always has been, it always will be on some level. So have we made progress? I think so. But it doesn't feel like the collective has really been able to detach themselves from the very flashpoint social media crash kind of inundation with images, and then we get overwhelmed, and then we kind of collapse and we kind of catch our breath. And I think for me, war was really effective. And I think what's important to note is, as much as the Supreme Court turned over this abortion law that's been about 50 years, when I look at the model of how that happened, there was a critical mass of persistent folks that were waiting practically 50 years, just chipping away. Yeah. And we got comfortable. I was going to say, we got comfortable as like folks that are like,
Thought it's never going to go away. I don't people, right.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
And they just chipped away. Take note. That's exactly what is effective.
Yeah.
It's not that we had this big flash in 2020.
Yeah.
It's the methodical organizing when it's not even sexy to organize. I saw people hitting up. I work in a church community. Organizing an anti-abortion, I'm like, y'all silly. I was like, y'all just silly. Like, what y'all doing over there?
Yeah.
Organizing an anti-abortion. I was literally in my head. I was just like, that's afterthought. Like, that's silly that y'all are still stuck at 19, whenever. And then I look up and I go, uh-oh, wait a minute. Noted.
Yeah.
Noted. So for me, as painful as that model is, and as devastating as that law being overturned is, let us remember that the underfunded, the majority unpopular, were effective in their methodicalness. And that part, I'm still listening for a bit. I hear it, but I think I could hear it a little bit more when I think of, like, did we make the progress? Not yet. But I just want to think, if any person listening to this asks themselves, not in a way of, like, shame on you, you gave up, but just really track and go, oh, how's my shaping happening on how quickly I may abandon a given practice because inconvenience is not happening collectively? And how can I really get a pace that I'm raising my hand as high as I can during the off season, in quotation marks, those are listening, as I would when everyone else is raising their hand, right? That's the question. So I think for me, that's more the inquiry. I would say we've made some really powerful moves. My fence is still standing. I have some things that have moved since then that are still critical. But when I look at the kind of rhythm of it, I feel like we're still maturing as a collective to be that unpopular, excited about anti-oppression. And not just when someone dies slowly on national television and gets the campaigns going, that we can get excited before the slow public death.
And what I find I'm looking for still is, what are the people who overturned Roe v. Wade? They moved people into positions of power. You know, they moved justices. Mm. They got people into places to make those changes. So they figured out how to apply to make the change. And I'm thinking to myself, so where is it? You know, how do we do that? And I know that's a conversation probably for another podcast, but in terms of sustainability, I find that being able to continue with this kind of work, it helps me to feel like I'm being effective in some way, right? It helps me to feel like there's like I'm applying my energy somewhere where it is going to make a difference mm-hmm. at some point in the long run, you know? Mm-hmm. Celebrating your fence. And
but I think this is the grief I feel, is I feel like white folks, especially the white folks I feel that are most effective in this work that I work with, I think their biggest challenge is they underestimate what really effectiveness looks like. I think there's a way that when we look at the smothering power of comfort, I'm a huge advocate for rest and care and beauty and nature. This is not new to me. But I think there's a way that when I look at white folks that are trying to do this work, they underestimate how invested they are into their cadence of rest that they have normalized in their ecosystem, even on top of people of the global majority, like literally on top of their land and their backs and their labor is actually benefiting them. I'm not saying like you should just jump off, but I talk about Bliss is Ordinary. I think there's a way that when we notice that we're on, folks, we kind of go numb and go, oh, I can't do anything about it. I don't want to give him a house. Fine. I'm saying is like, can we notice it and be in that grief and not abandon our joy, right? There's a way I see people pivoting too hard and abandoning their joy and being able to hold grief. I think one of the things that growing up in poverty and getting access to rest and all that, that we're able to be in deep grief and hold our joy. As much as that feels like maybe inaccessible or how to get there exactly, I want to say that there's something about folks are able to balance their grief and their joy and still be thinking clearly about moving forward and out of their situation that they're in. That I feel that muscle is kind of quiet in most white communities. And then I think, too, it's being skillful at integrating spaces, either having people integrate into their spaces or actually using their resource to actually be more thoughtfully invested in people's community and be in community with people of the global majority and African heritage folks. I think that's something that's not held as skillful as I would like it to be held when I look at that kind of methodical work. And the last thing I'll say is parents. I can't emphasize enough how much I will fly across the country work with parents, because I tell you, I think that's where I think a lot of folks feel like they're not doing anything, they're doing everything. Like, I think a lot of parents need to really organize and get in a culture of shaping the next generation with intention. And I see some amazing parents that are doing some amazing work, but there's a way that I feel like we're just a little passive. And raising these little anti-racist children is not a small task. And raising these little racist kids that don't have no better sense because they have been exposed in a way is also a big damage, no matter how much you march on the street. Mm-hmm. That lineage of handoff feels profound important to me. So I name those areas. I would take a little gander at again. I look a little carefully and see where you can be really effective. And it's not underestimating your own power. I don't know how many times people are just like feeling hopeless. I'm like, you have so much resource you could just do in your own like collective eight folks right there if you get slightly radical what you can do. So I think that part is just believing really how interested we can be right now.
How do you care for yourself besides singing?
So I'm a cuddler. I'm a human contact. You know, the Chronically Untouched Project will sip and say into this place all the time, but I'm a toucher and holder. So I take sessions virtually. I take sessions in person. So I do a lot of body holding, a lot of body contact. I say cuddling is an umbrella, but oftentimes it could be hand holding, it could be massage, it could be physical cuddling with our bodies. But really getting as many human beings cuddle with me as possible over a period of 12 months is medicine for me. But if you combine cuddling and singing, and maybe if I feed on the earth, I could probably live to 150 years old and not even flinch with no doctors or anything else. So, I mean, that's the magic trick. You give me a little sled, workout sled, strap me up, take off my shoes on a nice May day, and I walk and I get to the end of my little sled run and I'm breathing kind of hard. And there's some thoughtful human beings at the end of there that can hold my hands. I could sit and collapse into the earth and cut a little bit. And then we sing. Oh, my God. That there's not a therapist on this side of the Rocky Mountains that would give me more medicine than that.
I wish that for you every day then. That's beautiful. Is there anything you're excited about right now that you'd like to share before we go into a lightning round of questions?
Yeah, I'm doing our first Chronic Untouched Black Men's Retreat at the Whidbey Institute. And I also want to really appreciate a handful, three white folks that have been critical funders of this particular group. That means that all the black men that are coming that are unable to pay, we're only able to make sure they don't have to pay. Which I really find to be really important for us to gather for our own healing retreat, but also folks that even can't find plane tickets can also get plane tickets purchased. And that's really ridiculous that we can actually make sure that we're removing almost all the barriers in place for them. It's a small group of us. It's going to be about 10 of us probably are going to be gathering at the Blue Bee Institute. But it is, you got to understand, when I say 10 black men gathering to cuddle, work on touch, that's actually 1,000 black men. I just want to translate that for everyone. It's like, oh, well, I've been to gatherings of cuddling. There's been like 50 of us. No, no, no. But were they all cis black men or mostly cis black men present? Oh, I don't think so. So I just want to name that this is actually 1,000 black men gathering at the Blue Bee Institute in the form of 10. And that gives me chills. I'm nervous as chunk. We have folks that are trying to come there and they're 77-year-old child of a sharecropper to folks that are young in their 20s that are trying to be here and trying to figure out how to notice each other and touch each other if they feel so obliged to do so. That'll be a part of the thing. We have folks coming from all over the United States coming to this place just to be in this space. I'm excited. I hope this is one of many. So I'm really excited about that. In that weekend, we're also making a documentary about, we were shooting documentaries for a while, but we'll be shooting some principal shooting for the documentary for that, to amplify that narrative of the Chronic and Touch Project. And we're going to be singing, we're going to be touching, we're going to be noticing each other, we're going to be writing, we're gonna be meditating. But that's what we're excited, because this is ungoogleable. Ungoogleable. That's what you didn't know.
All right.
This is ungoogleable. It's the Greek that's ungoogleable. I'm excited about it. Yeah. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, yeah.
April 19th is technically sold out, but please, if you get to hear about this, find out when the next one is.
Yeah.
Talk to your cuddly brothers out there that want to be connected. And not just cuddling. We're going to be connected and singing. And cuddling is just in the moray of things that we'll be doing. But the touching piece is really important, though. It's not like an afterthought. It's going to be central to us being able to like remember how to not be violent towards each other and how to be tender and what that looks like and feels like.
Mm. Lightning round questions?
Sure.
Okay. What's an album that was really important to you?
There's an album that is a group named Acapella, Christian Acapella group. It's called Rescue. I believe Dwayne was one of the lead singers on that album, but it shaped our early years in the 90s. That album came out from the Acapella company, the album Rescue. Yeah, love that group.
Great. What is your favorite soup?
Favorite soup would probably be split pea, if it's done right. Oh my God, it's something better.
All right, with ham or without ham?
With ham.
Got
definitely
it.
A ham eater.
What is a sound that you feel strongly about? Doesn't have to be a pretty sound or an ugly sound. I mean, either one. Just one that you really feel strongly about.
Black men crying.
Mm. Who is an artist you wish more people listened to?
My sister, Lilia Johnson. She's magic. I can't wait till her work is bigger into the world.
Fabulous. Before we close, where can we find you and follow your projects?
You can go to cutproject.org for the black group. You can go to holisticresistance.com, holisticresistance.com for all my anti-racist workshops and things of that sort. And also you can go to what's my Instagram handle? I think it's cut.something. But I think holistic_resistance is the Instagram for that. And those are easy places to catch me.
Okay.
And if you're dead serious, you should just send me a text off my website.
Great. We will put all of that into the show notes too. So if you know, if it goes by too fast or if it's hard to find, it'll be in the show notes.
That's true. Yay, show notes.
Yeah, yay, show notes. A huge thank you to you, Aaron, and for coming on A Breath of Song, and a huge thank you to you, our listeners. I'm so glad you're singing. Visit abreathofsong.com to see the show notes that we were just talking about with links, lyrics, Patty Piotrowski's glorious artwork. Sign up to get artwork and music in your mailbox. Be one of the generous people who put something in the gratitude jar to help cover costs. Before Patty or I is paid, 25% is donated to the Jazz Foundation of America, which directly supports jazz, blues, and roots musicians in need. The skill and the artistry of these musicians has directly shaped a lot of the music that I share on this podcast. Yet historically, they have been inadequately recognized, unfairly recompensed. This is a small step toward restoration. Let's sing Hold On again to help it sink in more deeply. Now that we've had enough time for it to kind of disappear from our minds, we bring it back.
Aaron, are you willing to lead us through that?
Yeah.
Hold on,
just a little while longer. Won't you hold on? Just a little while longer. Won't you hold on? Just a little while longer. Everything is gonna be alright. Love on. Love on.
Love on.
Just a little while longer. Won't you love on?
Love on.
Just a little while longer. Won't you love on? Just a little while longer. Everything is gonna be alright. March on. March on,
march on,
just a little
just
while,
just a little while longer.
Won't you march on,
march on,
just a little
just
while,
just a little while longer.
Won't you march on,
march on,
just a little while longer.
Everything
gonna be alright. Build on, build on,
build on,
just a little while longer. Won't you build on,
build on,
just a little while longer.
Won't you build on,
just a little while,
just a little while longer.
Everything is gonna be alright. Jam it out. Boom, boom. Boom, 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 boom,
I want to thank you again for sharing the story behind that song for you, for helping all of us touch the grief and the persistence, the through that you accessed in that song, and for making that accessible to me, at least as a listener. I really appreciate that. Thank you, listeners and singers, for joining Aaron and me today on A Breath of Song. I'm grateful that you're taking care of yourself, that you're listening to your voice, that you're listening for what change you can be. I believe making a better world starts with the way we tune into ourselves and each other, which is what we just did, so yay us!
Yay us!
If you're liking this podcast, please share with a friend, and next time we'll plant another song. Until then, be well.